The little North German state of Prussia had been described as an army with a country, a perpetual armed camp, a gigantic penal institution. Even the built environment in Prussia was closely regimented. Streets were made to run straight. Town buildings and traffic were state-approved and regulated. Attempts were made to cleanse society of irregular elements like beggars, vagrants, and gypsies. All this intended to turn Prussian society into a huge human automaton, in the words of Hans Rosenberg. It was a state where scientific farming alternated with military drilling and with state-ordered meaningless tasks intended for no purpose but to subject the entire community to the experience of collective discipline, like fire drills in a modern junior high school, or enforced silence during the interval between class periods. Prussia had become a comprehensive administrative utopia. It was Sparta reborn. Administrative utopias spring out of the psychological emptiness which happens where firmly established communities are non-existent, and what social cohesion there is weak and undependable. Utopias lurch into being when there is no other social and political life which seems attractive or even safe. The dream of state power refashioning countryside and people is powerful, especially compelling in times of insecurity where local leadership is inadequate to creating a satisfying social order, as must have seemed the case in the waning decades of the 19th century. In particular, the growing intellectual classes began to resent their bondage to wealthy patrons, their lack of any truly meaningful function, their seeming overeducation for what responsibilities were available, their feelings of superfluousness. The larger national production grew on wheels and belts of steam power. The more it produced unprecedented surpluses, the greater became the number of intellectuals condemned to a parasitic role, and the more certain it became that some utopian experiment must come along to make work for these idle hands. In such a climate, it could not have seemed out of line to the new army of homeless men, whose work was only endless thinking, to reorganize the entire world and to believe such a thing not impossible to attain. It was only a short step before associations of intellectuals began to consider it their duty to reorganize the world. It was then the clamor for universal force schooling became strong. Such a need coincided with a corresponding need on the part of business to train the population as consumers rather than as independent producers. In the last third of the 19th century, a loud call for popular education arose from the princes of industry, from the comfortable clergy, professional humanists, and academic scientists, who saw schooling as an instrument to achieve state and corporate purposes. Prior to 1870, the only countries where everyone was literate were Prussia, its tiny adjacent neighbor states in Nordic Scandinavia, and the United States. Despite all projects of the Enlightenment, of Napoleon, of the parliaments of England and Belgium, and of revolutionaries like Cavour, the vast majority of Europeans could neither read nor write. It was not, of course, because they were stupid, but because the circumstances of their lives and cultures made literacy a luxury, sometimes even impossible. Steam and coal provided the necessary funds for establishing and maintaining great national systems of elementary schooling. Another influence was the progressivism of the liberal impulse, never more evident than in the presence of truly unprecedented abundance. Yes, it was true that to create that abundance, it became necessary to uproot millions from their traditional habitats and habits. But one's conscience could be salved by saying that popular schooling would offer, in time, compensations for the proletariat. In any case, no one doubted François Guizot's epigram, "The opening of every schoolhouse closes a jail." For the enlightened classes, popular education after Prussia became a sacred cause, one meriting crusading zeal. In 1868, Hungary announced compulsion schooling. In 1869, Austria. In 1872, the famous Prussian system was nationalized to all the Germanies. In 1874, Switzerland, followed by Holland and Belgium. Between 1878 and 1882, it became France's turn. School was made compulsory for British children in 1880. No serious voice except Tolstoy's questioned what was happening, and that Russian nobleman, novelist, mystic was easily ignored. Best known to the modern reader for War and Peace, Tolstoy is equally penetrating in The Kingdom of God is Within You, in which he viewed such problems through the lens of Christianity. The school movement was strongest in Western and Northern Europe, the ancient lands of the Protestant Reformation, much weaker in Catholic Central and Southern Europe, virtually non-existent at first in the Orthodox East. Enthusiasm for schooling is closely correlated with the nation's intensity in mechanical industry, and that closely correlated with its natural heritage of coal. One result passed over too quickly in historical accounts of school beginnings is the provision for a quasi-military, non-commissioned officer corps of teachers and a staff-grade corps of administrators to oversee the mobilized children. One consequence unexpected by middle classes, though perhaps not so unexpected to intellectual elites, was a striking increase in gullibility among well-schooled masses. Jacques Ellul is the most compelling analyst of this awful phenomenon in his canonical essay, Propaganda. He fingers schooling as an unparalleled propaganda instrument. If a schoolbook prints it and a teacher affirms it, who is so bold as to demur?